They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, Sarah Kustok is here. Yes Network, Fox Sports 1, Fox Sports, college football, NFL football. A lot of things going on in Sarah's world. You got an NFL game coming up, don't you?
I do. I'm psyched.
Now, do you feel like a fish out of water?
Cam Newton, Kyle Murray. Okay. No, you know what?
He's naming football players' names right there.
I know. We'll see what happens in week 2 to make it exciting. No, I mean, maybe I should. I grew up on football in the early part of my career, covered football for a long time. No, I find it fascinating. It's a different role, so it gives me an opportunity to look at things from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. My favorite part about it, which I don't think those that hire me are always thrilled with, or my game producer, my favorite parts are the coaches' meetings, because it's interesting to see, for as much as we get a taste of that in the NBA, to listen to how the NFL coaches game plan, strategize, like the offensive coordinator, defensive coordinators. I am fascinated by that.
I commend you. I don't think I could do it. I couldn't. Like, boxing is one, but I've been doing that for a while. Like, but if somebody asked me tomorrow, I'd be like college. I did college hockey once. It was like, I was just awful at it. Awful.
Because you were, had you ever covered college hockey?
No, it was totally new experience.
I feel like I'm back to my roots.
Okay, so this is familiar territory for you doing football stuff.
I mean, we'll see. We'll see what happens. Maybe it turns into train wrecks and I won't say the same thing. But I enjoy it. I love it.
All right, before we begin here, a little announcement. The Crossover Podcast is going on tour. That's right. Early next month, we're going to go on the road to do live shows in 4 NBA cities. The locations and the dates are as follows. October 2nd, we'll be at the Harp in Boston. October 3rd, at the Draft House in D.C. October 4th, we'll be at the 4040 Club inside the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. Sarah Kustok will be part of that event. And October 7th at the Improv Theater in Philadelphia. Right now, we're lining up some terrific panels, some great guests. Links to buy tickets for each show are going to be available on my social media channels. On Twitter and Instagram, I'm at SI Chris Mannix. You'll eventually be able to purchase them on SI.com and online at the venue location. There it is,
Sarah. This is a big deal. I am psyched.
I'm
for you, for us,
for the podcast.
I mean, this. I feel like I'm an active part of it. So
I'm a combination of excited and terrified. Like,
why?
Because
what are you most concerned with?
That nobody shows up.
No. That people will show up.
That you walk in like, hey, empty room. Like, hey, everybody, what's going on?
No, that one, that won't happen. Two, if not, you could have like crowd noise.
Like, go well, Boston, I'll just stack with like all my friends from Dorchester.
Yeah, no, people will come. My big question to you is, because throughout the years we've done this podcast, are you going to wear like the suit? Like, sometimes you're in a suit, sometimes you're in a t-shirt, sometimes you're in, I don't know what you're in.
So
what's the attire?
So for the podcast audience listening now, I'm wearing my Seattle Sonics NBA Jam
That's
t-shirt.
Pretty much what I want you to bring
This
up.
Is what I'm going to be wearing. It's very casual attire for the podcast series. Maybe I'll actually wear a different NBA Jam t-shirt in every city I go to.
I think you should have a theme.
Based on the city I'm in. Maybe it'll be a Celtics NBA Jam t-shirt, like Bird and McHale. Maybe in Philly, you go like Barkley and Hornacek?
Put
that together.
Yeah.
D.C., Wall and Beal. You can, I don't know how much further back. Maybe a Caron Butler and Gilbert Arenas. I don't know. Whatever you want to do there. And, Brooklyn's still new.
You could do like a Kid Carter.
You could, but I could even do Kyrie and KD there.
Oh, yeah.
Get new school with it all.
Yeah.
Right there. See, that's a good suggestion.
Were going to say like Brook Lopez, Joe Johnson.
Well, you will be wearing the Brook Lopez. Yours will be just Brook Lopez on NBA Jam.
I do have a
just Brook Lopez.
I have a Splash Mountain Brook Lopez shirt.
I have no doubt about that.
Anyway.
Speaking of Brook Lopez transition, part of the USA basketball team that lost early on Wednesday to France in the quarterfinals. Not a huge shock. It is the first time in 58 international games that USA Basketball has lost. They will not be able to compete for a gold medal at the FIBA World Championships. We kind of saw this maybe coming, you know, when this team was put together. These are very good players. Donovan Mitchell is an elite guy. Kemba Walker's coming off an All-NBA season. But if you want to grade the type of team it is, it's probably the USA Basketball C team, C-plus team. And when you're going up against these international teams, they don't necessarily have the same level of talent, but they've been playing together for a long time. So I guess your reaction to the U.S. bowing out in the World Championships.
I think a few of my initial thoughts on all of this, one, as you started to bring up, I think sometimes people can overlook continuity and how important that is with these teams. And so many of these international teams have played together for so many years. They have talent, yes, but they also have such a great familiarity with one another that this team, USA group, has just been together, you know, for the course of the last few months, few weeks. And so that takes some time. With that being said, I think it was really a huge positive that now they've earned themselves a spot in the Olympics. So I think that's something that can be taken off the plate of concerns or worry or pressure or stress. So I think that was a great thing. And I think, you know, even the game with France, you could look back on it and pick it apart, and there was some runs and they had the lead and you go back and forth with a lot of things. More than anything, when you think about a team representing a country, you want to think about the character, the way they play. These guys played hard and they cared. They were gritty. Were they perfect at all times? No. Could they have made some more shots at different moments? But you saw them grow together. You saw how much they cared. And I think for that, there should be a lot of pride in this group. And yeah, would it have been nice if they continued to advance? Of course. But I think with all being said and the way in which we saw them develop and grow together, I think you should feel good about the performance and the effort that group put out.
Yeah, I mean, look, it was a good effort. And they did lose guys along the way. I mean, Kyle Kuzma having to bow out before everything started. Jason Tatum getting hurt early in the tournament. That takes another scorer out of the mix. It was a flawed team, though. They elected to go small with this group. I mean, they had some centers. I mean, Miles Turner's a big man. Brook Lopez, we mentioned, was there. Mason Plumlee was there. But they were a smaller team, and that hurt them against France. France has got Rudy Gobert, one of the best big men in the NBA, and he played terrific in this game. They also didn't bring a lot of shooters, and that's perennially a problem for USA Basketball. And you know, having, you know, multiple guys out there that can make three-point shots. Joe Harris, as you know well, can make shots, but not a lot of guys that are what you would consider reliable three-point shooters. And when you have the de facto star of your team, like Kemba Walker, really struggle against that man-to-man defense that France played in this game, the margin for error is just really small. Now, you lose, big deal. Like, it ends a streak, you know. It's sort of end of kind of a run that USA Basketball went on beginning back in the 08 Olympics. But you wonder what this means for 2020. And will this inspire players, the star players, to come back and regain their status as the number one team in the world? Or is there going to be apathy for it? Now, you can certainly make the argument that the FIBA World Championships are in a terrible time. Like, the timing of it is just bad. You basically end the World Championships, and like a week or two later, you go into training camp. That wasn't appealing. And then if you want to do both the World Championships and the Olympics, you go from World Championships right into your season. If your season goes long, you're right into Olympic training. So it is like a year plus of, you know, full tilt basketball. But I'm curious, you know, will guys like, whether it's LeBron or Kevin Durant, or not Kevin Durant, obviously he's going to be coming off an injury, but the top tier guys from previous Olympic cycles, will they be inspired to play, or will there be more apathy towards it?
I think guys at this moment in time are prioritizing the NBA and their NBA season. So I think maybe some decisions, for example, with someone like LeBron, may depend on how the NBA season plays out, the postseason for him. If that comes into effect, how that impacts his decision. But just in general, some of those other top-tier players, or maybe some of those others that were asked prior to the guys in this group, I think so much has to do with the timing. And we'll find out. I mean, we'll see when it comes down to who decides to play next summer. But I think so much of it had to do with timing, location, just how this would have played into them preparing for the upcoming season. And you and I, we know this, and I've talked about this ad nauseum throughout the course of, you know, so many discussions having about who decided to play. The NBA season is a grind. And when you're getting set and getting ready for training camp, and these guys are getting themselves ready for, you want to be as mentally and physically prepared as possible. And so a credit to those players who, as I said, went out there and played for Team USA and put forth a great effort and were so dedicated and engaged in it. But also I could see the flip side of some of those who decided that it wasn't in their best interest or the best interest for the NBA, their NBA team, to play. So with all of that being said, I think what we see as terms as, is there more motivation? That will come down to who plays next summer. Because the timing, even though it's right after what will be the playoffs and the postseason, I think there is a different level of push when it's coming after maybe your top priority, after the NBA season, after what happens with your playoff run as opposed to prior to it.
I think you'll see everybody play next summer. I really do, regardless of how a player's season ends and when it ends, for a few reasons. One, the schedule is so much more favorable. You know, the Olympic schedule is effectively August. It gives you most of September off before you head into your training camp. So there is a longer rest period, which I think is going to matter to a lot of players. The second part is, for whatever reason, NBA players don't think of the World Championships like they matter. It's not, there are two different mindsets about winning a gold medal at the FIBA World Championships and winning a gold medal at the Olympics. It's just as simple as that. And third, I think there will be a lot of guys inspired by the fact that this team bowed out early and a chance to kind of, it gives them a little bit extra juice to try to go out and make that team. And Jerry Colangelo's reminded me that, you know, as recently as a year ago, players were showing up for the minicamp saying they were going to play in 2019. Now, circumstance came in the way, injury, end of season stuff, but I think there are going to be a lot of players that sign on to play. So I think the U.S. team will come back with a vengeance in 2020.
Yeah, and that'd be great to see. It'd be great to see. And I also think, you know, from our viewpoint or our perspective, we keep talking about what this Team USA is compiled of throughout the course of it. But this has been fun to watch. Like, yeah. I've enjoyed it too. I've enjoyed watching France. I mean, so many of those NBA players that we know and to see how they performed.
How about Argentina could win a gold medal?
How
is Luis Scola still playing?
On your NBA Jam Brooklyn Nets shirt, can you put Luis Scola? Do you remember?
Of course, I remember.
He had a solid season there.
He has all the time. But
I have a lot of favorites, but he's up there.
This is a separate conversation, but how Argentina never capitalized on the golden generation is beyond me. Like, that team that beat the U.S. in the early part of the 20th century or 21st century, there was never another generation. Luis Scola is still playing. Like, this team is still comprised of players that were part of that generation. Like, where is the
basketball?
Are you
saying why no young kids fell in love with?
Yes. Why? I cannot explain that. It's kind of the same thing with Spain, too. Like, Spain had that, you know, the Gasols and Rubio, and Rubio's still pretty young. But, like, there's not another generation. Where are these, you know, isn't that what those generations are supposed to do? Inspire young kids to strap on their sneakers and go out and play basketball?
I don't know. I need to take a trip out to Argentina next summer and find out.
Pitch that as a story.
I've got a research project.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about the NBA here. On Monday, the Wall Street Journal magazine released a story on Kevin Durant, the Nets' newest star, who's expected to miss all of next season with an Achilles injury. Durant, who is usually candid in these interviews, was candid in this one, telling the Journal that sometimes he hates the NBA. He had some critiques of the Warriors' offense. He said he didn't trust anyone in Oklahoma City or with the Thunder, citing the city and the team's reaction to his decision to sign with Golden State a few years ago. So I guess let's kind of break that down. The first part of it, how he sometimes hates the NBA and the circus that comes with it. What do you make of that comment?
I think, as you know, anytime throughout the course of stories like this or when you're spending time with a player and you're having conversations with them, on the record conversations, what I appreciate most about Kevin Durant is that he speaks from the heart. And he is very open and insightful about how he feels, about how he perceives things. And I know the way that that small sentence may sound. However, that's true. I mean, we all see this in the highs and lows of the NBA and being a business and everything that surrounds it, in the beauty and the greatness of the attention and how much people love it, the fandom. I mean, the way in which it's truly grown in terms of its popularity. But with that, there comes, you know, some challenges. And I think for a superstar and a player of Kevin Durant's caliber, that I can see, and that you can relate with. And so that's why, you know, that was the sentence, that was the quote that started the piece. And I think that's why it's really hit you right out of the gates. However, I think that's understandable. And again, it circles back to me to just the openness of Kevin Durant, of being so honest throughout the court. And he's been this way for a long time. The honest nature of which he expresses his thoughts and expresses his emotions.
Yeah, I mean, first reaction was, it made me think of Adam Silver's comments from a year ago, how he says he comes across far too many players who feel isolated or unhappy. And, you know, Durant, maybe he kind of fits that mold. The other part of it was, I don't know if Durant was this unhappy during his time in Oklahoma City. I think the unhappiness and sort of his hatred, if you want to use that word again, for the NBA and the circus that comes with it, stems from everything that happened in Golden State. And to that, I would say he did kind of know what he was stepping into there. He knew that whatever happened in Oklahoma City, it was going to be entirely different in Golden State. In Oklahoma City, he was the homegrown talent. Remember, like, how, what the reaction was when the Oklahoman had that headline? Was it Mr. Unreliable?
Yeah.
In that game, like, the paper was shouted down. People were, like, canceling subscriptions to the paper because they were critical of Kevin Durant. In Golden State, he became like a human pincushion. Like, anything that went wrong, it could be directed at him. It was never his team. From day one, he was the mercenary. So I would, and he didn't specify this, but I would guess that his feelings toward the NBA have evolved significantly since he left Oklahoma City and went to Golden State, because he stepped into a much different type of spotlight, a much different type of circus in Golden State.
Well, in just trying to navigate that and deal with that, I'm sure for him, I mean, we look at so many different players and the different journey or courses that they take throughout the course of their career, and decisions that they are free to make. But I think the way in which everything unfolded, you could see how he felt that way. Because to your point, and again, I think there's different levels when you are at the superstar status. There's only a handful of players that are at that level, of which Kevin Durant is at. But it was game by game. I mean, to your point, a daily thing and a daily watch of how things were progressing, the acclimation with Golden State, the acclimation with the team. And that's a lot to try and bear. That was a big burden to have to carry over. When you look at a player like Kevin Durant, and many you hear talk about this, in their minds they just want to play basketball. Like, they just want to show, they want to show up and get to the practice gym and play. They just want to play games. They just want to continue to try and refine their craft. And there's a whole nother. Again, this goes along with the popularity of the NBA and the way it's grown, but a whole nother fishbowl of which you are in, that every single move and everything that's happened is scrutinized at such a high level. And so I do think that develops. And I do think we could look at this with our own professional lives or in any capacity. I think the course of all that may change. I think there was also, and we may be getting to this, in his comments about Oklahoma City or how he felt, I thought it was very interesting when he noted to his return there, and not just being about the fans and the way in which he was treated by fans, but the equipment manager and the trainers. And those, I think he pointed at the front office. So just if he felt a certain way about his treatment by the organization itself, and I think that's a whole nother layer when it's those who you believe are inside your family structure, inside who you've spent so much time with.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Oklahoma City stuff, going back to Oklahoma, you knew what was coming. I was at that game, his return, and it was hostile. I don't think it was as bad as LeBron's return to Cleveland in 2010. That, to me, is like the gold standard for animosity felt by a fan base. But it was a hostile environment. There were fatheads of him out there and a lot of chants or whatever. There was the comment that, or the anecdote in the story that his mom told, that, you know, she got upset about a picture or a video of an Oklahoma City fan shooting bullets through his jersey. Well, I mean, it's Oklahoma. Like, it's, you know, some places set fire to stuff. In the Oklahoma, you shoot stuff. Like, that's just kind of the way it is. I think that might be a bit of an overreaction to be so concerned about how the fans react. That's just how fans react. Especially a team that, you know, just like Cleveland when LeBron left the first time, like, they were on the cusp. Like, remember that Oklahoma City team a few years ago? They were up 3-2 on Golden State. They thought they were better than Golden State. They believed that if Kevin Durant came back, they were going to the finals. Without him, they knew what happened. They were going to have to go through some type of rebuilding process. Now, the organization stuff, if he was seeing equipment managers and trainers like cold shoulder, that's a little dumb. Like, I don't, like, not from his part, I'm saying, like, of the equipment managers and trainers. Like, what are you doing? Like, you're a professional. You know, this guy's still the same guy. Like, you can't be too pissed off that he left. The organization, I thought, you know, publicly and privately, they've been very supportive of him. Like, they've never criticized him publicly. They've never said anything. Now, it was a little bit shady. I thought that, you know, you gave PJ Dozier his jersey a couple of years back.
Yeah.
You know, that to me is a little, like, you're eventually going to retire that number. Yeah. What are you doing giving it to PJ Dozier, you know, in the season after? I don't really understand all that. But, yeah, I just have mixed feelings about his feelings towards Oklahoma City. The fans got to expect it. The trainers and equipment staff, if they were giving him the cold shoulder, that's ridiculous. They shouldn't be doing that. The organization, if he knows something more than what we know publicly and talking to people within the organization, all right. But from everything I know, I think they've handled that in a pretty classy manner.
Yeah, I think it continues. When I look at all these situations, I keep circling back to, why should it matter our feelings about this? You know, this is his life. This is his career. This is the decisions he gets to make as a player. He was a free agent who decided to go somewhere else with his life. And as we know, it's not just about, which is a major factor and a major part, and you think about all that he did for that community and for that city, but it's not just about the organization or where you're playing, or sometimes you need life changes. Sometimes you want to play with different people. Sometimes it doesn't necessarily have to reflect poorly about the place you're at or how you feel. Sometimes you need changes throughout the course of your life and your growth and to grow. So that's why I understand with the big picture of going to the team that you felt like you could have beat in the playoffs, going to the rival, going to the team that beat you, all of these things from a fan's perspective. But at the end of the day, this is his own career and this is his life. It's not just a career. It's not just you're a basketball player on a video game. This is your life and what you're doing on a daily basis. So that's why even from the time that all happened, it's still he should have the agency to be able to do whatever he wants without opinions from the outside having to influence that.
What do you think of his criticisms of the Warriors' offense? What he was effectively saying was, when you get to the conference finals, you know, you've got to be doing a little bit more because teams are smarter and they're locked in on you. All that being said, in the last 3 years, Golden State's had the number one offense in the NBA during the regular season. In the playoffs, every year but one, they had the number one offense in the postseason. That year, they had the second best offense in the playoffs. So it's hard to look at the numbers and say that there were any issues with that offense. And, you know, to be fair, the offense was great when it had Harrison Barnes in that Kevin Durant spot. They won 73 games with that team. And, you know, when Kevin Durant came in, they allowed him to be more of an isolation player. Like, they created a different type of offense so that his talents could kind of flourish. What did you make of those?
That was one of the more interesting comments I found throughout the course of the article. Because that spoke to a lot. I believe it was not this past postseason, but the prior one, where there was a lot of discussion about that and just how the way in which Golden State balanced the idea of allowing him to be in more isolation mode, or allowing him to be a little bit more ball dominant than their offense typically was, given the fact of his talents and what he's able to do and his efficiency with the ball in his hands and how he could score. But that I found to be really interesting for as much as, you know, Steve Kerr, people are very open about, like, I would be fascinated to hear what Steve Kerr would think about that, or response to that, or just the idea that, you know, when you get later in the postseason, that that offense maybe wouldn't be as effective given what they've done throughout the course of, you know, the last five, six years. So that I found to be more interesting.
They have played with fire a little bit in the playoffs. I mean, you look at, what was it, 2 years ago against Cleveland, or was it Kyrie's last year in Cleveland? Was that 2 years ago? When they won it, what did they win, 4-1 in that series? But there were a lot of close games.
Yeah.
Like, the early ones. I mean, Durant pulled their fat out of the fire. Was it game three?
And that's like, and that's, to me, in my mind, that's almost reminiscent of what he may be, like, the things that he's talking about of where he needed to go off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, have those big games and really take over the game and get away from some of that motion offense. So that's where I think it's interesting. And that's where I would like to, after reading that, I'm like, gosh, I'd like to go back and watch some of that film, or watch some of those games, or dive deeper into the numbers of those games, because that is an aspect. I also think with Cleveland, too, that was a different scenario given how many times they matched up. In the fight, or how much, because I think also in that quote, he alluded to the fact of teams that know teams can better combat what you're doing, and they know what you're doing. Like, also, how much does that play into the fact of you're meeting the same opponent who's gotten used to you, scouted you that much, which I guess you could say in the early rounds. But that there's just different ways to kind of match up and strategize. So that is what I was most interested in, and would be more interested not only to hear what his thoughts are on it, but just the team or Golden State, or just how they feel about the nature of that and how they felt throughout the course of some of those later rounds in the playoffs, and if that felt in any way had some truth to it in how they perceive things.
It's interesting to hear him say that, too, because in Oklahoma City, it was very much kind of your turn, my turn with Russell Westbrook, where there was enormous pressure on him, like, not just in the third round of the playoffs, but every single game. Like, if he had a bad game, chances are the Thunder were going to lose. It just wasn't as much margin for error. This was more of a free-flowing system they had in Golden State. I wonder, and maybe you can answer this, how what he thinks of the Nets offense and the way Kenny Atkinson plays. Because I don't know if it'll be your turn, my turn with Kyrie Irving, but those are two ball-dominant type of players that are more in the mold of Durant and Westbrook than they are what Durant had in Golden State.
Well, and that's where I'm curious to see the progression of this, because obviously with Durant not being there this season, or at least for the better part of the early part of the season, all the deep dive into when his return may be, but for the purposes of now, Durant doesn't play this year, let's say, what does their offense look like? I assume it'd be very similar to what we saw last year. The amount of pick and rolls that D'Angelo Russell ran, I can see the same thing going on with Kyrie Irving, and just the type of pieces they have, a whole lot of similarities. So what is the progression of that acclimation of Kyrie Irving, some of these new pieces, and then how does that change when Kevin then comes into play? Because whoever is in that four spot is going to be used drastically different than how you would use a player like Kevin Durant. So that, I think, is going to be interesting. And I do, though, I think to that point, those comments that he had about knowing it was as simple from the inside as the outside, the decision to join the Brooklyn Nets, that he felt like it was a fit. He believed and trusted the front office, the moves they made, the young core that they had, wanting to be in New York and in Brooklyn. But obviously, as he said it didn't need a PowerPoint. So it seems that those discussions of what things will look like, how he'll be utilized, the agency that he'll have throughout the course of that, I believe it'll be a work in progress. But obviously, he has a lot of trust, because that wasn't something necessarily that he needed checked off, a box checked off, before he agreed to come there.
A problem for another year, 2020-ish.
Are we already in the 20s?
Yes. Time flies when you're have no life. All right. Let's talk about what's going on with Andre Iguodala in Memphis. In July, as we know, Iguodala was traded from Golden State to Memphis in what amounted to a salary dump. The Grizzlies got a first-round pick in 2024 for taking on Iggy's contract. Now, Iguodala apparently wants out. The Grizzlies, of course, in the very early stages of a rebuild, are not complying. According to The Athletic, the Grizz have no intention of buying out Iguodala. Instead, will bring him to training camp, presumably until a trade offer materializes. Sarah, what do you make of Memphis's decision here?
I first have a question for you in the specifics of all of this, which are things that when this was all taking place, when Golden State was discussing this with, whether it was with Iggy to begin with Memphis to begin with, do you believe, is when this all unfolds and in the process is going on, is there a conversation of, because this all had, because the Dwight Howard situation, they traded for Dwight Howard, I think it was a few days before that, shortly after that. So that went along the same process of what I believe was expected out of Andre Iguodala, that, okay, we'll bring him on, buy him out. Do you think there was some type of understanding amongst parties that that was a situation that was going to occur? Is that a conversation that even takes place? How does that all happen?
No, I don't think there was an understanding between Iguodala and the Grizzlies when the deal happened. My understanding early on was that Iguodala didn't even know. I think he knew he was getting traded because of the circumstance, but didn't know it was going to be Memphis. Now, the Howard situation is different because there's no market in a trade for Dwight Howard.
Right.
Like, he's coming off an injury plague season, and he's Dwight Howard. Like, they're just, you look at what the Lakers gave him in a contract. Iguodala is valuable. The second Iguodala hits the free agent market, there's going to be several contenders.
And there was even reports that the Grizzlies were exploring the trade market when they first brought him on. I don't know where I stand with this, because obviously from the side of Andre Iguodala, a guy who's likely in the last year of his career, just the resume that he has, the understanding, of course, that he wants to play for a contender in doing so. And then we've heard of all the different teams and possibilities and landing spots he would like to be at, that in accord want him to be there. It's tough. It's tough to think that he's going to have to show up at a training camp with Memphis in a place that really has no postseason aspirations. They're a young rebuilding team. So, you know, from certainly the short end of the stick for Iguodala of having to do that. And you could see why he wouldn't want to do that. And I think on the Memphis side of things, would they like to get something out of it? Of course, you could see the reasoning behind it. However, I look at it in some ways of if you're an organization that's starting from the ground up, you're trying to rebuild. You could see whatever vet, if they want a first round, you know, pick attached to, they already got one, but if they want one attached to a trade. In some capacities, though, I think, do you think about building goodwill for the organization? Do you think about being a place that, you know, I don't want to say you have to be player friendly, but that does right by players, does right by player? I mean, Iguodala is the, what is he, the vice president of the NBPA? I mean, he's a guy who's one of the most well-respected in the league. Is there a certain extent of which you feel some type of give back in order to build that goodwill for your organization? And I'm not sure if you think about, oh, we'll be a good veteran presence for some of these young players. There's no guarantee. I don't think he's going to not. You know, who knows with him talking about showing up or not showing up for training camp. But just because he's always been a great veteran and a great leader doesn't mean if this is not the place he wants to be, this wasn't the expectation for how he's going to continue the last year of his career, you don't know that he's necessarily going to be there mentoring all of your young players for those purposes.
I mean, look, as far as the goodwill that Memphis could generate by acquiescing to Iguodala, to hell with that. Like, forget that. Like, it's malpractice unless Iguodala says to them, I'll give back every nickel of the, I think it's $17 million he's due this year, you hold on to him. You hold on to him and you wait for these contenders out there to realize that you're not screwing around. Because
when do you think that would happen, though?
Maybe it's midseason. Maybe it's before the deadline. Maybe if you get past the deadline, then you know, your bluff has been called, then maybe you buy him out. But until then, first of all, it's a lot of money. Like, you're going to give him like $14 million to not play for you? I know we think about the NBA payroll in abstracts, but that's real money you're just handing a guy to not play for you. Second, the NBA, as you know, more wide open this year than it's ever been in decades, maybe.
Right.
So there are a lot of teams that are waking up on the first day of training camp thinking they can win a championship this year. Iguodala, even at 36, can be a difference maker on those teams.
Oh, for sure.
He's got championship experience. He can still defend at a high level, occasionally make shots, be a playmaker for you in a pinch. There's value there. So, again, unless he's saying, take it all back, you could every nickel. The buyout is $1. That's all you have to give me. $1, and I'm going to walk away. You do it because there will be a team, I think, that'll give you something in exchange. Maybe it's not a first-round pick, but maybe it's like a young player. Maybe it's something that you get back, which is better than nothing.
It's a fair argument. It's a fair argument, and I see your
point.
You're
the sentimental type.
I am. I think for Andre Iguodala's sake, I'm the sentimental type. I too think there's some value in making sure that you are an organization that for a place like, I shouldn't say, but Memphis is not always one of the top free agent destinations. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, but I think so, it's never been.
A place that wants to build as an organization and build in ways. I think there is value to doing right by a player that has put together the career that a guy like Andre Iguodala has. I think there's something to be said for that and something to be said for doing right by the player. But I think it's looking at both sides. Like you could see both sides.
Look, Andre Iguodala at some point is going to get to finish the season on another team. I don't believe that if we get past the trade deadline, Memphis will hold on to. If for no other reason than like, Iguodala might help you win. At that point, Memphis is probably going to be trying to lose, like because right. They're just so young and they're going to be so bad. But until then, close your eyes and think of England when it comes to Andre Iguodala. Like, just play through.
Have we been at a situation where a guy has not shown up for training camp?
We must have. I'm blanking right now on that. But I'm not sure that Iguodala would do that because he wound up getting fined and lose the money anyway. And I know it has the potential to be a circus for the Grizzlies, but I think there's too much value to be gained by holding on to him and trading him to somebody, because whether it's Houston or any of the Eastern Conference teams, a whole bunch of Western Conference teams, somebody out there is going to want Andre Iguodala. Somebody out there is going to say, maybe it's like mid-December, that mid-December date when players sign in the office right. And get traded, when things kind of open up a little bit. Maybe it's then that you can make a deal for him there, but I don't think they should let him go. I understand why he wants to go. I totally get that, but he's getting paid. The contract is the contract. And if Memphis think they can get more value, whether it's a pick or a young player, I think you got to hold on to him. Two sides of that coin right there.
I'm with. Okay.
All right, let's talk about one of your boys there. Joe Johnson, fresh off an MVP season in the Big Three.
Joe Jesus.
There you go. Former Net. Johnson could be in line for another crack in the NBA. Johnson, who last played in the league with Houston in 2018, has been working out for teams, including Detroit, which I'm told is very interested in Joe Johnson. Sarah, Johnson played 23 games in his last season, averaging 6 points. He was great in the Big Three, but at 38, can he help an NBA team?
I believe he can help an NBA team. I also think it's a little bit deceiving talking about his last season and his averages, just given how he was utilized in Houston. And so I think, in some ways, especially Joe at his age, we talk about his age, but he has always been so diligent in taking care of his body and taking the steps of whether it was doing hot yoga or his diet or how he's eating, all of those things. I think the numbers of his last season were more product of what Houston was trying to do, how they were trying to run their offense. And so I think that's one factor to it. And Joe, he could be a great just scorer off the bench. Like, you think about your second unit, someone coming in and being able to just give you buckets. He's also, I mean, in covering him in Brooklyn, but just you ask anyone that has been a teammate of his, he's one of the great teammates and great guys. And I think he, too, is a player that just wants to keep hooping. That's why he played in the Big Three. That's why he's just kind of went through the phases of whatever role he's going to take on a team. I don't think he will give you any issue with that. So, for example, we talk about Detroit. I know he's they're a team he's worked out for. He used to be represented by Arne Tellem. But they don't have a ton of scorers off the bench. I mean, you look at, okay, who's their second unit? So I think he's a guy who can come in and give you that. And I also think he'll be a great add to the locker room. I think he's a good veteran presence. And so for that, from those respects, I think, yeah, absolutely. He can. Are you getting a ton from Joe Johnson? No. But are you getting a solid add to your roster if you have availability? Yeah.
I was talking to someone that coached Joe recently last night, and one of the things he said was that the key is, you know, where do you put him defensively? That's the biggest issue. And he can't defend twos. He can't defend threes really anymore. You basically have to make him an undersized four,
right,
in a spot duty. And I guess in today's NBA, where lineups have become more creative and small ball is in vogue, you could potentially do that, but probably no more than 10 to 15 minutes every single game. And that's something, you know, playing four is something that I was told Joe was not really keen on in the past, you know, being kind of put in that type of position. But if he wants to get back in the NBA, that's probably going to be where he's going to line up, because you can't have him scoring on one end and giving up twice as many on the other end. That's
right. And to that point, I'll say that, and you're correct on that. I would say even his last season and a half or so, maybe 2 years in Brooklyn, he did play some four, and he was starting to move in that direction of playing the four as the game had changed, and obviously lineups had gotten smaller. And I don't think he loved it, and he would joke about it, or he'd joke about just the wear and tear on your body, banging on guys that are so much bigger. I mean, he's I think in terms of body width and physicality, he's got that. I mean, he's about 6'7" or so. But I do think the way lineups have been manipulated and changed, and again, this isn't a guy that you're talking about, oh, can he fit into our starting lineup? Oh, can he give us 25 minutes a game? If he's coming in and giving you a solid 12 to 17, 18 minutes a game and able to do so in that position, I also think he's at the point where, and we see this with a lot of players, did he used to love playing the four a few years ago or back when he felt like he could still hang with three? Probably not. However, if this is what it's going to take for him to be back on a roster and be back in the league, I think he's someone who would be all for it. He's someone who very much is, okay, whatever the team needs, I'm willing to do. And that's why I think it would be a fit.
What a huge boost for the big three if Johnson can get back into the NBA.
No kidding.
All of a sudden, not only does it become kind of a way for guys to keep playing, it becomes sort of a feeder system for older guys to get back in. I mean, the first thing I thought of was Carmelo. And I don't know if Carmelo winds up on a roster at this point. It's looking challenging, to say the least. But if he goes through an entire season and still wants to play, he could sign up for the big three and maybe show some teams he can still score, show some teams he's still in shape, show some teams that he can be, he's just dedicated to the game, that he could be the next guy to join that. Because, you know, Johnson, if Johnson didn't play in the big three, he wouldn't be stiffing the NBA right now.
No, because people are thinking about the last season he had and the lack of playing and the lack of playing in the postseason. I will say, regardless of what happens with Joe, I still think it was a huge boost for the big three. Just even the dialogue, the talk, how much we have mentioned that. I think there were even more eyes on it because Joe Johnson was a player who was so recently in the league and in a big name coming from it. So, yeah, but that would be big time.
Yeah, Joe Johnson, I mean, he could play in the big three till he's 50. Like, his game is conducive to the half court isolate. It's iso ball. Like, that's all it is. That's what he does. Incredible. All right, let me finish with DeMarcus Cousins. DeMarcus Cousins tore his ACL last month, and in all likelihood, it's going to be lost for the entire season for the Lakers. They went out and replaced him with Dwight Howard. This, of course, the third significant injury for Cousins in the last 3 years, making a bad situation worse. Cousins was recorded threatening his ex-girlfriend, a threat that led to Alabama issuing an arrest warrant for misdemeanor domestic assault. Sarah, it was 2 summers ago that we were talking about Cousins as a max contract player. There was virtually no interest in him this past offseason, and next summer he'll turn 30 and have a lot of baggage attached to him. Is it possible that we've seen the last of DeMarcus Cousins in the NBA?
It's hard to even think that, given the fact of, as you mentioned, we were talking about him and a max deal 2 years ago. I was going back through his numbers and just through the course of those 5, 6, 7 seasons towards the end of Sacramento and in New Orleans, and just the you remembered him putting up monster numbers, but how he was scoring, the way he was rebounding, how effective he had started to become from the three-point line. So it's so tough to think about a player that had that much upside and that much potential when he was 25, 26, 27. Now we could be talking about, is he going to even make his way back to the league? But these are not small injuries. I mean, think about the fact you got your Achilles. What was it, the quad? And then now the ACL. I mean, that is all
trifecta of bad leg injuries.
Brutal. So to be coming back from that in your 30s, and obviously some of the questions about the off the court stuff, questions at times that you had about him in the locker room. I think you put all of that in its totality. Do I think that we'll see him again? Yeah. Do I think that at some point some team, once he's healthy again and playing the big three, showing off his skills. Do I think a team may give him another chance? I hope so. But also, I never anticipated we'd be for so long talking about, will Carmelo Anthony get another chance in the league? So there's so many play. I mean, it's amazing, as it always is with this league, but it's amazing how much timing plays a role in things, how much what a team needs, what needs a team has, roster spots open, available, how that all factors in. And so when DeMarcus Cousins is healthy, when he's back, when is he going to be able to show that he's getting back, start to play? Where does that fall in the course of a season? You know, because if depending on the calendar of the year and depending on when it seems like he is ready to hit the floor running and being back and playing 5-on-5 in script, depending on when that is in a year, could play a role in when a team may be able to pick him up or needs them or doesn't need someone. And if another season then goes by, who knows? I mean, it's for better or worse, you know, things happen quickly and younger players develop. And all of a sudden you look at someone who has a potential injury riddled last few years, as opposed to a younger guy with some upside. And that's where it becomes tough decisions for organizations. But do I hope we see him again? Yeah, of course you hope that. But I think it's a real possibility that we potentially have seen the last of him in the league.
Well, the game is going away from players like him, has been for a while. He was able to kind of stay above that fray because of his incredible talents and because he did start to adapt as well, becoming more of a three-point shooter. But, you know, he's going to need, I think, an advocate on a team next summer. Like, he had Anthony Davis on this Lakers team who liked playing with DeMarcus Cousins in New Orleans and had no interest in playing center. So you bring DeMarcus in, and he is kind of an ideal fit there. He's going to need something similar, I think, next year, because all the baggage is starting to get up. Now, I have some sort of a side note. I have some mixed feelings on what happened recently with him and the ex-girlfriend, and I'm curious to get your take on it. I mean, what he said in that recorded interview was reprehensible, full stop. Like, you can't say stuff like that. He was also set up a good on that one. I mean, he's asking to bring his son to his wedding, and it's being recorded, and she's baiting him a little bit, and all of a sudden it's on TMZ. Like, he was set up there. I think what he said was awful. What she did, I think, was equally bad in kind of setting him up. I don't know all the details about their relationship, but I hated that. I'm not sure I would hold that against him as much as some of the other stuff that he has kind of going for him, going against him.
And I think any form of domestic violence is wrong. I think everything should be handled equally, fairly, with a zero tolerance policy. However, I think when it comes to it, and once he's healthy a year from now, and teams or whenever it may be, teams looking at potentially could he be an add to their roster. I don't think that's going to weigh as heavily as other factors. I don't think that's going to weigh as heavily as what will his character be and his willingness to buy into the big picture of a team be, his production on the floor, how he fits in terms positionally and production-wise. I think all those things, health concerns, I think all those things probably will be just as big, if not bigger, factors in, okay, is this a guy that we want to give an opportunity to on our team?
He did. I mean, it is interesting. He hit the market healthy this past summer. Like, he came back from the injury.
Yeah.
He was a pretty good soldier, I guess, in Golden State. And he wound up getting a contract that was less than the crappy contract he signed for that 1 year in Golden State. He got about $5 million last year. This one was about three. I don't know what the market's... I can't think of a team right now that goes and gets him. Now, things certainly change, and maybe an injury happens, things open up, but it's going to be hard, and we don't even know how he comes back.
To me, that's the question, because with all that, and that's what I mean by these injuries. These are not small injuries. These aren't a broken bone or a sprain or something that's happening to your upper body. These are serious, serious injuries taking place with your lower body. So that, I think that will factor in just as much. And to your point, he just turned 29. He'll be 30 next year. That will factor in just as much.
30. I remember 30. Good year.
Oh, was it? That's, I hope my 30 is.
There you go. Now we're talking. Sarah, we'll continue this conversation October 4th.
I can't wait.
40-40 Club at the Barclays Center. Stay tuned for ticket information for that. For the record, none of these venues are big. I'm trying to keep it as a small, kind of intimate-esque setting. The Harp in Boston is small. The 40-40 Club will be relatively small. Improv Theater in Philly, small, and the Draft House in D.C. are small.
But I'll invite all my friends.
Yes,
to ours.
Make that happen.
Yeah,
that's why I bring people into the panel.
All three that are listening.
We're just so sad. Sarah, as always, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Mannix. Mm-hmm.